Welcome to Popcorn Psychology, the podcast where we watch blockbuster movies and psychoanalyze them. My name is Ben Stover, and I'm an individual therapist, and I'm joined by...
Brittany Brownfield, and I'm a child therapist.
Hannah Espinoza-Rimas, and I'm a marriage and family therapist.
We are all licensed clinical professional counselors, aka therapists, who practice out of Chicago, Illinois. Even though we are licensed mental health professionals, this podcast is purely for entertainment purposes and to fulfill our love of dissecting everything pop culture in all its forms. Today we're going to be discussing Logan. Logan was the swan song of Wolverine, the final story in his, or final chapter in the story of the Wolverine. In our podcast today, we want to cover, we're going to break down three characters, Charles, Logan, and Laura, who are main characters in the film. We're going to be talking about dementia, depression, trauma, and attachment issues during this podcast. We're going to start off with Charles today. Charles, throughout the movie, Charles has been a professor. He's been this huge influence on the world of X-Men. He started the X-Men. They're named after him. And in this movie, we see him in his, spoiler alert, last days.
Yeah, I know. It almost feels like we've never done a spoiler before movie. I was thinking about this before we started, and I was like, this feels like we might have to maybe do a spoiler alert right now before we start. Just because I know some people may listen who haven't watched the movies, and so if you really don't want to know what happens or you think you might get spoiled, don't. Because there's a lot of
spoilers.
Death we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Charles definitely, at the onset of the movie when we see him, he is very out of character. I think that's probably the most glaring thing we notice is he's belligerent. He's screaming. He's yelling at Logan. He's swearing, which I don't think I've ever heard him swear that I can recall.
No,
he's and not. He said the F word like multiple times throughout the movie, even when he was quote unquote medicated.
Yeah.
Very mean, like just like mean to
just
Logan,
like cruel,
in a way that is so out of character for him. Like even in the past, because he's been such a mentor figure, and even in the past movies when he's been like stern or trying to make a point, it's always from that very loving professorial vibe. Of like, this is for your own good, but he's just like roasting his ass. Like when he was like, when I found you, you weren't anything, and now you're this like piece of shit. Like it was very horrible to see. And
just throwing everything in his face. I mean, telling him that, you know, I gave you a family, and just kind of being Charles in the exact opposite way that he normally is, which is being very gentle with Logan, with him, and being very just kind to him, and it's the complete opposite.
Definitely.
And it happens right away. It's like the opening of the movie. Like you see how different he is and how different their dynamic and how different their relationship has changed.
Right. I mean, you see him slumped in a chair, and like the first thing that I noticed was that Professor X is always impeccably groomed. Impeccably. And they showed him with like this like stringy hair left on his head, and he's always been like completely clean shaven, and he's slumped in his chair, he's always sitting up straight, he's always very proper and calm, very much your Jungian wise old man, like always.
I think the storytellers of this movie do a good job of like right up front kind of telling you as the audience that this isn't the story that you expected to see. This is very different. And for me, as a therapist watching it, my first thought was, oh, Charles must have some form of dementia. And I don't know if that's what you guys saw as well.
Immediately.
Yeah, same.
Because, I mean, I don't have a lot of personal professional experience with dementia, but from what I know about it through just school and the diagnostic manual is, like, personality changes are a big part of it, which I think is the most prominent symptom besides... I mean, I guess not. That's not true in that he's a lot of like incoherent thinking. Like he's talking to himself. He's doesn't make sense. Like the story he's telling kind of when he first enters. Well, when Logan first enters the scene he's in, like I can't even remember what it was about, but it didn't make any sense. Like it wasn't a coherent story and it wasn't about what was going on around him.
No, he was like singing from a musical.
Was that what it was?
Yeah, he
was like, and he was going back and forth, and then Logan is standing in front of him, and he's like, will you please move, sir? Like
he didn't recognize him.
Didn't recognize him, didn't recognize that he was in a room. Like, that's, I don't know, it was very...
And then just, being, like, fighting Logan, like, I think he ends up falling down, or, like, getting on the ground or something.
Yeah, he falls out of his chair.
Yeah, because he's fighting him, and then... Yeah, it's, and just very, being very... just mean and just so out of character. And I know that's something that, from what I've read, is a big indicator of someone, what can be really hard with caring for someone who has some sort of neurological disorder. Because I guess what we could also say is, from what I can glean from the diagnostic manual, it's not really called dementia anymore. It's called a major neurocognitive disorder. It's mm-hmm. all kind of lumped together. It's like the same vibe of Alzheimer's, and all those disorders are like lumped together pretty clumpy in the diagnostic manual. Like,
right. Everything got more, like, they put it, all of the like major and minor neurocognitive disorders into one category and then made it so you could be much more specific with mm-hmm. which brain structure or what might have caused the particular neurocognitive issue. But when we're looking at Charles, the term most people are going to be familiar with is Alzheimer's or dementia.
Which, and I just want to clarify that, because technically it seems like that is an outdated term now.
It is.
But it is what people say colloquially.
Correct.
Also, how irritable, I guess when we say mean, also, he's so irritable. Like, he is just really agitated, and that's a big symptom of someone who's having a neurological issue like this.
Yeah, having a hard time managing emotions and managing frustration.
Mood swings.
And then there's also the part of him having seizures, and how that, and because he's a psychic, a really powerful psychic, that his seizures are just stop everything around him, and everything goes into chaos and people get hurt. So I mean, it's just, and also his memory, mm-hmm. clearly, like his memory, like we were saying, his, he can't really piece together stories, and it's mm-hmm. confusing when he's lucid or not.
And it's also like he's having periods of lucidity, and that can be an indicator, you know, because it's, because like when you look in the diagnostic manual, you want to make sure that you're not confusing it for like some sort of psychotic disorder, which clearly it wouldn't be, because you wouldn't present that late in your life with schizophrenia or something like that.
Right.
But there are, can be psychotic-ish symptoms, because it's just, a lot of these symptoms are the similar as a psychotic disorder, like incoherent thinking, like intangential thinking, like speech, you know, confusion, talking to what seems aren't things that aren't there, you know, not recognizing who's in front of you. Like, kind of almost like an being in a delusion, like a delusional state. Like, you're out to get me. Why are you trying to hurt me? Like, what are you doing to me? Because of the confusion they're experiencing, can present as more of like a schizophrenic type of presentation, which he has all those symptoms. And I don't know what kind of, I mean, it's hard to say because it's 2049. So who knows what like neurological medication looks like by that time. Probably looks wildly different. But, you know, he has to take some sort of medication that makes him lucid, but they're very obvious because they're, I mean, it's a fantasy story. They're not clear about what it technically is.
Yeah.
That seems to bring about periods of lucidity. I don't know how realistic that looks, because I don't have a lot of experience with these kind of disorders. So I don't know if that's something that's real.
You know, I'm sure you could get on Twitter or Facebook and find trolls who will tell you exactly what the science is and isn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it'd be interesting to see, and reach out to us if you know, like, what nurses who work with people in these situations, like, if they have that experience with people. Like, is the lucidity brought on by just natural lucidity that comes and goes, or when they're medicated, is it better? And also, because it's, we can get into the real dork part of it, which is the thought of, well, when you're dealing with someone who's also a mutant or psychic.
Level 4 mutant, like, that.
Okay.
There's the dork. Like, see, there's the darkness
to it. You saw my dork, really, and you raised me.
I raised it.
You raised it.
I raised it.
And so it's like, God knows what his brain looks like, period. So it would be really interesting, in just kind of like a thought experiment way of, I wonder what his brain looked like to begin with. And then adding to a neurological disorder, it almost makes you wonder if because of his brain being different, is that what caused him to have a neurological disorder? Or, you know, vice versa, like the chicken or the egg hypothetical.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, I mean, in combination with Charles is the guilt factor. I mean, several times when he is lucid, well, I don't even know if it's necessarily when he's lucid, he will start bemoaning, you know, understandably about what happened, I guess, a year before in the story.
Which he doesn't find out about until they're in the hotel. He knows.
I thought he knew about that.
He knows about it.
He, they t- he's, they hid it from him. He said he doesn't know. He doesn't find out exactly what happened. He knew something bad happened, but he didn't realize like all the damage he could destruction he caused.
Until he heard it on the news.
Until he
when you're they're right. in Vegas. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then he has this combined guilt.
So the only thing about dementia that I know about from having a family member who struggled with it is that I do believe that there are times when people are just lucid on their own, mm-hmm. but that it really comes and goes, and that as the disease progresses in general, that it gets, that happens much less, mm-hmm. but that it does happen even without medication, because I know the medication they have now is somewhat effective, but I don't believe that they've found it. But I haven't, it's been a while since mm-hmm. I've found out any information about that. But there's definitely some guilt that he has about, once he does find that out, about what happened. And you can tell that he understands what that means. He's very mm-hmm. sad and very upset.
What also how, because like in terms of his identity too, like even in like the movies where he's played by like James McAvoy and stuff, like he's a very cocky dude. Like he has moments in the movie series where he kind of like falls, like has like a fall from grace, but for the most part he is like a very competent of his skills. He's very confident in like being a mentor and a leader.
Yeah, he's a teacher. I mean, if mm-hmm. he's anything, he's a teacher. Like that's what he's always, the area that he's always thrived, because he right. learned how to use his powers effectively and mm-hmm. really be able to help other people, that he just wants to be able to help everyone and teach other people how to manage and use their skills mm-hmm. to help others or to get their needs met.
Right, which is interesting that we only see really Patrick Stewart's version of like falling from grace. The James McAvoy version has his own like fall in mm-hmm. One of the
Days of Future Past,
right, when he trades his powers and his status to walk. But in like an X2, when we see Charles get manipulated by Stryker's son, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
When he gets manipulated and mm-hmm. like put in like psychosis to the point where he's like finding all the mutants, find all the mutants.
But even then it's like something that happened to him. And I think this is the first time we see him where he is, I mean, which I'm sure is a common, like, what's the word I'm looking for? A struggle that a lot of people as they get older, especially when they have a neurological condition, they can't control, of like the loss of yourself and the impact that must have on you emotionally, mentally, of who am I? Like, when I wake up from these periods of lucidity, what have I done? Like, needing to be taken care of in that way. You know, not being able to look the way you like to look, like you would have been. Like, being prim and proper. You know, he's clinging to that role, too, still. Like, when he starts to hear Laura, and he's very insistent. Like, there's a mutant out there. Why aren't you believing me? So you could, you can make the argument that a lot of his like quote unquote mood swings and irritability that you would attribute to the dementia could also be just general frustration with getting older, not being respected like you used to be.
Absolutely.
And because he gets so mad at Logan when he's like, I'm mm-hmm. trying to tell you there's a girl out there who needs our help and you're being a prick.
Yeah. Well, and also his not being able to be a teacher anymore.
Yeah.
And how I noticed, as soon as Laura comes into the story and is actually in his, he can actually see her, he knows that she's real, mm-hmm. his demeanor kind of changes.
He becomes pretty chipper, actually.
Yeah, he's kind of excited. His like calming, sweet voice that he used to use with Logan all the time and in mm-hmm. all the previous movies where he's played that role, that voice comes back, him being calm and speaking kindly and being gentle to Laura, because he's back in a role in a place that he knows how to deal with kind of taking in someone who doesn't know how to manage their powers or who doesn't know how to connect or whatever the case may be, where he really feels like he can teach them and mentor them.
Which really comes through when they're in the hotel room right before like shit goes bad. Aww. When he's teaching her about Shane.
Yeah, that was very sweet.
Like you see that coming through and her talking about like this is a very famous movie, you know, it's almost 100 years old, which is a very interesting story that they chose, because you know like Shane is where the white hat, black hat, like bad guy, good guy comes from. Yeah, Shane, the movie.
I've never seen it.
That's where, because Shane always, he's the cowboy that wears the white hat. That's why the good guy wears white hat, is because of that movie.
Oh. I mean, he's also very like, even in the midst of all the chaos in the beginning of the movie, when the floor first pops up, he's like, are you okay? Do you need anything to eat? Like, he's being very, like, grandfatherly to her.
Yeah.
And when it's, like, chaos around them. Like, he very much reverts into that role with her immediately. And she, she responds in kind, which is interesting.
Yeah, she does.
And it's actually an important thing to bring up, because that's something that you're starting to see with being done at nursing homes.
When they bring little kids in?
They'll bring kids in and essentially make nursing homes more like a daycare or a preschool, and they have give the patients there something to do and something to look after, and sometimes they bring in kittens or cats just to live in the nursing homes to give the residents something to put an identity of being a caregiver again into, and that really helps. And then having kids come in is the same.
Well, I've seen the video of, like, the preschool that's in the nursing home and how sweet that is, and it will make you cry if you Google that video and watch it. It's pretty sweet. But I think it is that thing of...
Like, face-leaking type of crying.
Yeah. But I think it is that thing, like you said, where it's making them feel... Well, one, it's human connection and compassion.
Absolutely.
I think we forget about that. When people get older, they become invisible. I mean, to a certain extent. Or we stop looking at them like people and start looking at them kind of like animals, kind of, in a way, or like things you have to take care of or put up with.
Like a burden, yeah.
And so I think there's a natural frustration with that. And it's probably not recognized enough. And there's probably not enough mental health components to nursing homes and, you know, older, you know, assisted living, and recognizing that frustration and why maybe they are picking fights over stupid bullshit and, you know, being a pill.
Right. Yeah. Some nursing homes have them. I know the one where my grandfather's at, he's not in this unit, but I know when we went to visit him, the facility he's at in central Indiana, of all places, has a whole memory unit.
Oh, okay.
Specifically,
that's cool.
And something that I thought was really interesting about this that I think would be, I mean, maybe we can talk about it more in treatment section, but they have pictures of who they were up, like, outside their room, and so, like, how things to help them remember who they are and what they are. But
well, it's also probably, like, I'm sure there's probably a big component of that is your identity, like, remembering who you were and people respecting who you were.
Right. And in this movie, we see Charles mention that, you know, like, to Logan.
Like, I used to take care of you. I found you, you little shit.
Right. Right. And, like, multiple times when he's just, like, going back to that, like, I used to be this, I used to be that, and, like, why aren't you listening to me, like Hannah was saying, like, why don't you hear me, like, I'm telling you, I'm trying to tell you, and then, see, I told you.
And Logan's doing that thing, which is not good, which is kind of treating him like a thing, like, I'm putting you in the bed, take your pills, like, no discussion, like, writes him off a lot, and doesn't really respect him as a peer anymore. He kind of treats him like a baby.
Well, I think, and that's part of going back to, like, the nursing home and having... letting the older generation really teach the younger generation. They have wisdom. They've lived a whole life, and they have are still living and still experiencing things. Mm-hmm. And so really letting that be a part of that and giving them that role of being respected, you know, working with kids or with whatever, just to help them, which is the same, which is what we see with Charles and Laura. And giving that chance of being able to use the skills that he has and the identity that he had before to do that with her.
I mean, exactly what you said, like, respecting that they still have something to offer.
Yeah, and not writing them off as, you know, this idea of them being a burden or waiting until they
gone. Die. Yeah.
And that's all that they're worth, or they've done everything that they could already in their life. Mm-hmm. And that now they just have to go to a place where we don't have to think about
that. We just have to keep them comfortable until their life is over.
Right. Okay, so I feel like that's leading us right into some of the things we wanted to talk about with Logan.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things we see where we can start off is the caregiver fatigue.
For sure. I mean, that's the one of the first things I thought of when we talked about doing this movie is caregiver fatigue. I mean, like, right off the bat, too, it's a similar thing of, like, how he's treating Charles is not okay. And I'm sure part of him realizes that, which is part of why he's got his own, like, irritability going on, is feeling like, well, where do you put your feelings when you're starting to resent the person that you love, that you're taking care of, and then the guilt that comes with that resentment.
And also, how do you deal with them when they are being combative with you about taking their medication and about following through with things that,
and
you know,
maybe yelling at you
and yelling
you
at you. And I mean, like, we had I have experienced this exact thing with someone that I loved and cared about. It was a thing where we had to trade off who gave my grandfather medication mm-hmm. because he would take it. He wouldn't take it from my mom, but he would take it from me without any fuss at all. Mm-hmm. So it's like there's that part is that's a real thing that can happen with people who are either struggle with whatever is going on with them, just being mm-hmm. taken care of like that. Like they can't take care of themselves. And so they yeah. can get like that. And so I think we see Logan just kind of, he doesn't know what else to do. And he's been doing this for a while. And and he's been fighting a losing battle for such a long time, trying to take care of people that he loves. And it is never easy. And his experience doesn't usually go very well.
And I guess we could say up front, caregiver fatigue is exactly what it sounds like, which is the burnout or, it's called caregiver syndrome. It's not in the diagnostic manual. There's no official diagnosis of caregiver fatigue. You'd probably be diagnosed with some version of adjustment disorder or depression yes. or something because mm-hmm. it's based on an outside stressor, which would be taking care of someone. But it sounds like exactly what it is, which is becoming fatigued and burnout by the chronic, consistent stress of taking care of someone who, like we said, might be belligerent, might be getting in your face, or just might be really ill or just a lot of fucking work. And in the case of Logan, having limited support and limited resources.
Absolutely.
Right. And I feel like the part of the purpose of Stephen Merchant's character even being in it was to help illustrate that.
Like they almost have a dynamic of a couple that have to take care of one of their parents.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's they definitely, and they might've done that partially for joke, for levity in the movie, but they're kind of naggy back and forth in the beginning.
Right.
I remember watching and being this is probably a conversation that's happened in thousands of households where they're taking absolutely. Care of an elderly relative or just a chronically sick person in the yeah. home.
Or a baby.
That's true. Or or a very sick child or something like mm-hmm. that, which is one person's, goes out, they each have their role and they each get pissed about what their role is because they get tired of doing their role or they feel, you're both so burnt out that you probably both feel like you're doing the more than the other person, even though you might both be doing an equal share or shifting, doing a lot of it.
I think you're right. I mean, I think it's also that idea of what did they do with all those feelings they're having about what is going on?
Like feeling resentful and then feeling shitty about being resentful.
Right. And what do you do with that? You take it out on the person that you can, because you're not going to take it out mm-hmm. on the person that you're taking care of because that feels even worse.
Yeah.
And so it's easier to just project it all over the place and kind of end up with these, hostile conversations about mm-hmm. who's, I did the dishes 2 times last week, and it kind of can end up turn into something else just because there's so much stress when you're taking care of a loved one. There's so much stress around that. And it's a really hard experience for anyone.
And I think this movie did a really good job of accurately portraying what that looks like. Yeah. Just wore the fuck out. It looks a lot like depression in a lot of ways, which we could also argue it could be a whole separate thing that Logan is struggling with. He is irritable, he looks tired as hell, acting out on the people around him, hella moody,
isolating
for sure,
carrying around a bullet in his
suicidal, so I guess that's a big one, actively suicidal in his thinking,
suicidal thoughts. He just is holding on to the bullet for when he's ready for it to be over.
Right, when he's done, he's planning his exit.
Yeah.
He has a plan. About, right, when Charles dies and he's out on his boat by himself. And mm-hmm. For the life of me today, I can't remember Stephen Merchant's character's name.
Caliban,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Caliban, even brings it up to him, I think you're planning your exit. I think you're planning without me, and I think...
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Have me on a boat below deck all the time? I can't be in the sun. You're planning your exit. He's accusing him of you're thinking mm-hmm. about killing yourself. Your powers are weak. You're losing it.
Mm-hmm. You're clearly ill and you won't do anything about it or not interested in doing anything about it, which something that happens with caregiver fatigue is kind of putting off all of your own needs that mm-hmm. you need to get met for yourself, whether it's physically or emotionally, and kind of putting those all to the side because all your energy is wrapped up in taking care of this person.
Technically, studies have shown that in people who suffer from caregiver syndrome, it affects your immune system. It not only affects you emotionally, but it has a observable impact on your physical being, like how well you're able to recover from things. And so it makes you also argue, like, is his other stuff going on, like his inability to heal, like how he's not as strong anymore, like is this being compounded by also this caregiver fatigue that he's and depression that he is like coming under, like is this all
connected, like, wrapped to up each in other. Each other? Yeah,
I mean, because I guess the argument the movie makes is it's because of that poison that was in the water, right? Did I just totally derail? Didn't the bad guy put something in the water that killed all the mutants? Did I not rewatch the same movie?
No. So he's
how did
sick.
All the mutants die in this movie?
They were hunted down.
Oh, I thought he put something in the water to change people.
He stopped the gene from mutating.
Okay, he did something.
Yeah.
But
he like
Logan anyway. Is sick from the
adamantium.
Yeah, oh, from yeah, the metal that's in his body is poisoning him.
Yeah, and I guess he's only had like, that. It's like he's only rusting, had that in his body. Well, he's only had that in his body since what, the '70s. So it would make sense that like he's lived for 300 some years, but it's like now it's killing him because he's only really had that in his system for the past what 70. By the time this movie's kicking around,
something like that.
So I mean, he has all this stuff going on. I mean, he is wore the fuck out. I mean, he's drinking a lot, but I know we talked about this, like being a lot of the traits of depression Logan are kind of his personality traits that he's always had.
Yeah,
like he's always been really irritable, he's always abused substances, he's always been kind of impulsive and self-destructive,
and he's always isolated also, like he never wants to talk to anybody and mm-hmm. kind of just keeps to himself and really isn't really interested in making lasting connections with other people because he's lost so many people and has struggled with that.
Which I guess gets into the next argument about Logan, which is is he depressed or has depressive symptoms due to a long-standing traumas of losing everybody in his life because of his immortality.
And all of the series of terrible things that have happened to him is depending on which particular storyline you follow, like Sabretooth is either his father, just a friend, his brother, like it just depends on which point in time you're looking at, but this character has killed his wife.
I mean, he's had multiple romantic partners be killed tragically. His mom didn't his mom die tragically?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's weird stuff going on with his dad. If I remember correctly, or maybe because that one story, Sabretooth the character, apologies.
Awesome.
Was like the product of his mom's affair with like the gardener, right? In the Origins movie.
Yeah, in the Origins, so, that piece just, of trash.
But
yes.
just go, what I mean by that is like there's a lot of like family disconnection, losing family members in certain different ways, having this weird combative sort of relationship with his maybe brother Sabretooth, whatever, and then like because in all these movies the common thread of all the Wolverine X-Men movies is he meets somebody, he becomes very close to them, and then something really horrible happens to them, may or may not be his fault, like even in the first X-Men movie with Rogue, who he like kind of takes on as like his little ward.
Yeah.
Like he accidentally stabs her once.
Yep.
And then she gets killed in the end, and then he brings her back to life.
Right.
Like he's at the heart of all of these, like he does a lot of like holding a dying woman in a lot of these movies.
A
lot of like screaming into the wind, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, even the Japanese soldier from The Wolverine, like he ends up, you know, like that guy becomes, spoiler alert, the Silver Samurai, the villain at the end. Like,
sure.
Didn't see that one?
But like, and I did see that one, but I think only once.
The movie The Wolverine?
No, I don't think I saw that
one. But it's good.
It is the common thread of he gets close to someone, something horrible happens to them.
Correct.
Mostly his fault.
Which is what he says in this movie. Like, everybody I care about dies just by being around me because we are mutants, we are hunted, and I can't keep you safe, and I also can't keep doing this to myself. I can't keep getting connected.
So he's just, like, wore out by life. Like, life has burned him out. Which I wonder, I mean, this is a real nerd thing to say, but I wonder if that would be a common situation with anyone who is immortal. It's funny to say it like that, but like for someone who had lived that long, you would just naturally have a lot of people die around you, especially I mean if you were like an isolated immortal person, like unless you know, but I got a little dark. But, like, just the crime. And also it makes sense, like, maybe that's why he is so stubborn with Charles. Is, like, yes. I'm going to fucking keep you alive.
I'm
going to
keep you alive. It's the last thing also, I do. And also it will be the last thing I do because I'm going to kill myself after that.
Right, because that's the last thing.
That's keeping the final alive.
All that I care about is keeping you, who I think we would all agree he views as his dad,
mm-hmm.
taking yep. care of him. Like, I'm going to take care of you until I can't. And until you're dead, I'm going to stay alive until you're dead. And then after that, I'm out.
Right.
Because I can't. This has been...
Which is also something you see sometimes in people who are suicidally depressed, which is they have one thing keeping them going. And
yes.
once that thing is gone, they're done. Like, I'm going to stay alive for my kid or until this happens or that happens, which... is not good because anything that relies on external factors is very scary.
Right, because we don't have control over those things. Mm-hmm. And having somebody finding something like that and really clinging on to it can be really hard, especially as a therapist, because it's hard to help them see other things or other ways that they can help deal with those feelings or other things that they can do.
But it's also a common thought process when you're depressed is, if this external thing happens or stays the same, then I can keep going. Or if this would change, then I'll feel better. You know, it's yep. not the internal work, because that's too hard. And I mean, right. it also makes sense with all the loss of why when Laura pops up on the scene, he is so resistant.
Yes.
He, like, leaves her multiple times, refuses to acknowledge her. Because if you were to compare that to, like, the first X-Men movie, even though he was, like, resistant to Rogue or Marie, like,
yeah.
you know, being with him, he got on board with it pretty quick. And then once yeah. he decided he was going to take care of her, he was very like, I promise I'll always take care of you. He followed her onto the train. He was always very loving with her.
Yes.
And with Laura, he's just, and even after he finds out that she's his actual daughter, he's like, no, thank you. No, thank you. This is not my problem.
Like, yeah, I feel like he definitely pushes her away a lot until he sees her fight the guys from that company that I can't remember the name of, the bad guys. I don't know what to call them. Those.
Yeah,
people.
Right. And so, as he sees that she's him.
Then he
yeah.
gets it. Because I feel like that, because that's when he pulls the car around and picks her up and
yeah.
then leaves. So mm-hmm. I feel like that's the first
time. But even
time.
Then he says to Charles, we'll find someone else to, we're going to drop her off somewhere,
yeah.
basically. And Charles is like, no, we are those people that are going to help her. And he's like, we'll find someone to help her. Like, he's even then like, we'll get her to this place and then we're done. Like, there's
yeah.
no, like, I'm going to continue
well, they
to
already
be there.
Found, I mean, they already found them and have already compromised him being able to take care of his dad.
Yeah. Like, he definitely continues throughout the movie to prioritize Charles.
Yeah.
Like, even when
yep.
the twin Logan show, like, the evil twin Logan shows up.
X-24.
He, yeah. and he's got Laura. Like, he literally has her. He looks at her and then runs upstairs to check on Charles.
Yeah.
Like, he makes a very conscious decision in that moment of prioritizing Charles first.
Right. So when we say that we think that Logan's demonstrating symptoms of depression, what are the symptoms of depression we see?
Irritability, suicide, ill thinking.
See, lack of enjoyment in...
Oh, he's got no joy.
No, he's got no, he's got no joy.
He's got no joy.
But, you know, isolating himself, no joy.
Substance use, but he kind of always have had substance use. I mean, I guess you could argue that he's been chronically depressed for a number of years.
Yeah.
In and out. He probably has had bouts of depression throughout. And probably only really didn't experience them when he was part of the X-Men, when he
yeah.
finally found a group of people. So, I mean, he's very explosive. Like, he's very... I guess when I say irritable, like... he's very aggressive in his language. Like, he's very off-putting, like, purposely, you know, acting out on others.
Mm-hmm.
He looks tired, so it's, like, physical fatigue.
He's not
yeah.
sleeping.
Yeah, I imagine he's not sleeping.
He's
yeah.
not. Caliban points that out. He's like, I know that you're not sleeping.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is...
all signs of having... of struggling with depression.
Physically weak as well, which you could say that's a big part of maybe... I mean, it's probably not helping the poisoning going on in his body. Probably not fighting it at all.
No, he's probably not. And when you see him, like, he looks ragged. He's not taking care of himself. He's not putting effort into being a functional human being. He's doing the minimum he can to survive.
Yes.
Yes. He definitely is just going through the motions. Like, if Charles wasn't there, I don't think he'd still be there.
No. So we know through his dialogue and then through Caliban's dialogue and even some of Charles that he's having... that's already enough criteria to meet a major depressive episode right there.
Yeah.
Right, you need five.
And you would probably just...
more than five. Easy.
Put like an additional little what we call Z-code diagnoses of, you know, sick... relative that he's taking care of, family dynamics.
When you say Z-code, what does that mean?
A Z-code in the therapeutic world
is when
we do diagnosing for like paperwork and stuff, there's usually the primary diagnosis that we send to insurance to prove that the people we're working with deserve to have their mental health treatment covered. And a Z-code is kind of like not a official diagnosis. I mean, it's not like a primary one like depression or anxiety. It's more just like where you'd stick the environmental factors, like problems in your marriage, you know, childhood abuse, things that have an impact on why you're presenting the way you're presenting, but isn't a mental health diagnosis. But it informs the person who'd be looking at the paperwork of where this person's coming from, why they're experiencing the things they're experiencing, and, you know, why you're doing what you're doing with them in therapy. Because having childhood trauma might not be a diagnosable thing if you're not presenting with, like, post-traumatic stress disorder, but it might be an indicator of why you react a certain way things do, or why you have anxiety about certain things, or why you have triggers of sadness about certain things. Yeah. And that is a Z-code. And also, I'd say with him with a Z-code would be, I don't know if this is a Z-code, but... I mean, the continuous losses he's had, like survivor's guilt, like he's had so many people that he couldn't save, and also the loss of identity that comes from that. Like he, I mean, I'm sure this
would
was
you, a, go would ahead. We give him a secondary diagnosis of PTSD?
I think that
with
Logan, I would argue that it's primary. He's clearly showing depression.
Over depression?
I would argue that PTSD is, because when we talk about PTSD, depression is part of the symptomology.
It is.
That presents with PTSD. Mm. So this would be where you were doing a rule out process with the diagnosis, where you're trying to figure out, like, okay, are we rating this on what's most significant right now, or what's the most correct diagnosis? But
because
much criteria for PTSD. He's got
clearly having nightmares.
He's having nightmares. You see it, and when he's
that's true.
Like
he's always
he's
had
yelling.
Nightmares too. That's chronic.
He's yelling. He's responding to the nightmares audibly. Like he is still.
He's hypervigilant.
He's hypervigilant.
It's hard though because he has a realistic reasons to be hypervigilant though.
Well, I mean, so do trauma survivors. But
true.
He's got he's avoidant, like actively avoidant, like whether it's through his drinking or not talking about things or
he is very avoidant. I mean, being aggressive is a way of being avoidant too.
And it is. And it's one of the primary reasons I think he does it, even with Laura.
Maybe
like
he is. God damn it, Ben. Maybe he is.
But
I guess this is also a good point to bring up, which is...
because negative alterations in cognitions and mood associated with the traumatic events beginning or worsening after the traumatic event occurred.
Yeah.
And he's got so many traumas. So many. Like, again, like...
he has so many big T traumas.
Big T loss. I mean, like...
I mean, loss after loss after loss, and just watching people being hunted and not being able to protect them and
Just like he's been experimented on. That's bodily traumatic.
Absolutely.
Like just the pain of that.
Right. There's no way you wouldn't be wondering if you're going to die.
Yeah.
In that moment, whether infusing metal into your skeleton. We know he volunteered for that, but...
he lost his memory, so then there's that trauma of, like... who am I? Where am I? Like the disorientation of that, not knowing who your family is.
Watching Jean Grey become Phoenix and then like losing her. And then
he had to kill her, right?
Then he had to kill her.
Damn.
Which they retconned all of that with Days of Future Past, like which makes comics timelines very difficult to prove. But we don't know. We know that Wolverine remembered that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he went back and he's like, wait, Jean, you're here. And then like his whole memory of everything. Didn't go away. He still remembered all of it.
I mean, yeah, so he still has the mental health effects of those memories, because whether or not they're technically still real,
right,
they have the impact within him because it's how he remembers everything.
That's his story, his narrative.
But I mean, I think the point you said, though, is that regardless of the formal diagnosis, his presentation is what we work with as therapists. So it brings up a good discussion of regardless of what the diagnosis is,
yes,
you treat what's in front of you And depression, it's like you said, depression and PTSD have a big middle ground in the Venn diagram of the two of those diagnoses.
Absolutely.
Very big. And with his world, like, it'd be impossible to ignore. Like, one of the things I think that gets glossed over with trauma, too, is the diagnostic criteria of the new DSM, it got a lot harder to actually give someone PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have more things, more specific diagnosis. In the past iteration of the DSM, giving PTSD was fairly easy to do. It was never an easy diagnosis to give someone. But the criteria for, you know, determining that someone met this disorder was a lot easier then. And I made it more specific and more hard to avoid people getting trauma diagnosed, like a PTSD diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a chronic diagnosis and looked on unfavorably by insurance companies, for sure, like life insurance, etc. Which is why sometimes we're hesitant to put down labels like that on people. Mm-hmm. But with Logan and any client in general, like Brittany is saying, you want to be sure you're meeting them where they are. It's not about what letter code that they get, what acronym we can apply to you. Are you depressed?
Well, because it's the thing where... I mean, I'm sure we've said this already in past episodes, but like, this is where mental health treatment looks very different from physical health treatment, in that you don't need to have the specific diagnosis A to give them the right treatment B. Like, there's no A equals B. Like, with physical health, you know, have, you know, this illness, you need this medication, you have this deficiency, so you need this vitamin, you break your leg, you need a cast.
But like, you have to have that diagnosis in order to get the medication.
Like, we've all seen House. You have to know the exact thing to do the exact treatment.
Right.
According to that show. And with mental health, it's a lot more like, it's just not concrete like that. It's kind of all just like clustered up.
Right, you're healing a whole person's
thoughts,
identity, feelings. It's and they're complex and layered. It's not like having the flu. When you treat the right bug, they stop throwing up.
Because I have people I've worked with who I've diagnosed with anxiety disorder because that's the criteria they fit. But what they're distressed most about is feelings of sadness, and so you treat them maybe more like you'd treat a depressed client.
Right.
Than an anxious client, because that's how they're experiencing it. Or vice versa. Like, I work with people who are very depressed, but they're very stressed or burnt out for another reason. So maybe you would treat them more like an anxious client, or a PTSD client more like a depressed client, you know?
Right.
Because it isn't cut and dry like that.
No, it's really, I mean, it's what we've talked about, I think, in past episodes. It's person-centered. It's what the client is coming in, what they're asking for help with, where they're at, what they're ready to work on, and what they need. And the diagnosis is, as we've already, you know, said, is for insurance purposes, to prove that these people need to get the help and should be allowed to have it covered
right.
by their insurance companies to get the treatment that they need for the goals that they are looking for.
And so I think what's interesting, segueing into Laura, the third big character of the movie, is that she also has trauma. Obviously, she was literally a lab experiment. Probably raised not too dissimilarly from maybe someone in a really bad orphanage state. Like, when we think about like those sad videos of kids in raised in orphanages where they don't get touched and they have attachment issues. Whereas Logan presents as very typical PTSD. In my perception, Laura presents more as someone with chronic attachment issues.
Yes.
And by what I mean by that is literally how it sounds, like your ability to attach and relate to other people. And she doesn't have necessarily the specific diagnostic criteria of PTSD. Like, we don't know a lot about her, actually, but she's very flat. She doesn't interact facially with Logan or Charles or Caliban at onset. Even when she's around her caregiver, that nurse, she's not very reactive. I mean, she acts caring towards her, but her face is still pretty blank. She doesn't speak for the majority of the movie. And she has zero life skills and social skills. Like, she eats with her hands. It seems like she doesn't know how to relate to other people.
No, and absolutely no impulse controls.
No impulse control.
And so she's also a product, though, of trauma, more like neglect-oriented trauma.
Yes.
In kids that I've seen before, where they're just not... I mean, they're kind of at the you know, not to sound crass, but kind of like a feral child, like raised in the wild, like kids who are so neglected that they kind of just behave like animals. And by what I mean by that is a very like survival based, like a wild animal. Like she's constantly evaluating threats versus non-threats. Like it seems like how she sees people is, are you going to hurt me? Or are you not going to hurt me? And if you're going to hurt me, I'm going to literally chop your head off and I'm going to have no problem with it. Because an animal wouldn't have like a moral issue
right.
about protecting themselves and destroying another animal to keep themselves safe.
Exactly. And they're also trained. I mean, they're trained to be soldiers. That's what they were trained to do. So it's also like she also has the ability to do that really effectively as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And side note, Daphne Keene was a badass in this movie. Just have to just put that out. Like, they made this kid a badass. Like, it's really sad. But, like, the actress, like,
well, if it makes you feel better, when I was looking into the stuff, Hugh Jackman has a daughter the same age, and he said that he would, like, take her and his daughter together to the water park, like, on Sundays. And he's like, and she'd be, like, a regular kid. And then we'd go into the next day on set, and she would just be, like, stone-faced. And he's like, but also there were times when we would do... She did a lot of her own action scenes. Like, when she jumps over his back, that's really her.
Oh my gosh.
He goes, well, we had to have a talk because she started laughing. She was having so much fun. She would start laughing as they practiced it and as they kept doing it. And he'd have to be like, remember, you have to look scary.
Yeah.
And she'd be like, oh, okay. Because she had a lot of fun doing it. So what's nice to know
She's is amazing.
That she wasn't, you know, bogged down by this role.
That's good, because we do see that sometimes with actors, which maybe we should talk about at a later time. But yeah, when we see this character, this loss of social skills that she never learned, like, become really a prevalent part of the experience she has.
Well, I mean, she shows a lot of signs of another trauma diagnosis, which you give to children, which is called reactive attachment disorder, which is the symptoms of, you know, you're distrustful, you don't like people touching you or getting close to you, like you don't respond to caregivers appropriately, you know, you're pretty shut down, you don't really like do a lot of social cues, like you flat-faced is a common thing. I don't know if that's a criteria or it's more things that I've seen anecdotally when I've worked with kids that have reactive attachment issues. You do have weird, very black and white about things, like either like the way she is, like either you're a threat or you're not a threat. Like it's very, like you don't attach to people in an appropriate way. Like you're more like you are in a survival mode, because kids who are diagnosed with reactive attachment have one of the key components of diagnosing them is chronic abuse in some fashion or trauma in some fashion as a kid, which can even include like having multiple caregivers, which she does. She, you know, getting tossed around, getting neglected. I mean, every kind of caregiver she has dies in this movie, like that nurse. Yep. Dies, Logan dies, Charles dies.
Well, violently, and some of the other nurses at the when they flee and they just decide they're going to take the kids because they figured out that they're just killing them, basically.
Yeah.
And so seeing like just being a part of that and seeing all of her, like what her little family was like. But I also, you know, wonder what it was like when they were growing up and what that looked like. Cause they're still pretty young, clearly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the parts of them being babies and what we were talking about, like, were they held by the nurses? Were they like what?
Yeah.
Because it seems what you're saying is just not having any, just not being used to being around people.
I mean, to be extreme with it, you're not being raised like a human being.
No.
And you're not being raised to relate like a human being.
Well, they certainly weren't being treated that way either. Yeah. I mean, they weren't allowed to have names and...
Yeah. And another thing she does, too, is when you do get food. A lot of kids I work with who have attachment issues because of neglect and trauma, like, they eat food very, like... Well, they scavenge it. They shove food in their mouths because they're not sure. Every time they get food, it's like, will I ever get food again?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure food was, it's probably manipulated in the lab experiment against them, like eating and not eating.
Absolutely.
And also like using her hands, like kids I work with that have had this kind of trauma, like they almost eat like the stereotypical like ex-con where they like are bent over their food with like their arms around, you know what I mean?
Protecting it.
Yeah. And so, I mean, she displays a lot of, I mean, she's very unfazed by things that should bother her. Like when she, I remember the part where she gets the glass in her arm and she sucks it out of her arm and she spits it out like no big deal, which I'm sure everyone saw as a badass. But what I remember when I saw it, well, looking at it again as a child therapist, being like, God, she does not operate on the same plane of existence.
No.
Like, she does not receive things the way we receive things.
No, I saw that. What stuck out to me was before we were really introduced to what she is or who she is.
Yeah.
I mean, Charles had hinted at it, but when the agency is just showing up and, like, she knows there's danger. It's obvious at this point. Yeah. Armed men are showing up and she's just sitting there eating her cereal calmly.
Well, and also because she has because you could argue too, the reason why she is like that is a combination of their attachment issues, but also that she knows that she can cut their heads off. So she's got that extra component, which I'm sure screws with her identity. Of, I know I'm powerful. You can't. I mean, I can't imagine working with a kid like that who also could kick my ass. Like, literally. Because I've had kids with attachment issues try to kick my ass.
Yeah.
But I could, like, I'm bigger than them.
They're little.
But I can't imagine if those kids also had, like, knives that come out of their hands and feet.
Yeah, right. That's a whole different level to it. And something that I think is important for us to mention when we talk about RAD a little bit is that, to know that
which is reactive attachment disorder.
Reactive attachment disorder. Yes, there's my jargon-ness happening again. But when we see kids with reactive attachment disorder, that it can come in two different ways. It doesn't just come in, like, the detached, don't connect to people. It can also come in the form of connecting to everybody.
Well, there's a new name for that now, which is, I can't think of it off of my head. It's something that's like D something. I apologize as a child therapist for not knowing it. But it's like, because until very recently, reactive attachment was what you just said, which is either, it's two ends of the same spectrum. Either, of two ends of the spectrum. Either you're like, no, to everybody, and like hand out, super off-putting, super defensive, or you're, oh my God, I love you. Like, you meet someone and you're just like, I love you and I'm hugging you and I'm all over you and I've never met a stranger, and like, you'd call a stranger daddy that you just met, and it's like there's no social skills in either direction. Either there's no connecting or there's no boundaries.
Right. It's basically the Gloria from Wedding Crashers.
Oh, yeah. Well, that could be a lot of things.
But, it could be a lot of, well, I mean, we find out she was manipulating that situation. But like the persona she put on, I love you, I find you.
The name of the other one is disinhibited social engagement disorder.
I knew it was one of them, a D. Yeah. It started with a D. Because it used to be disinhibited or
inhibited.
It used to be reactive attachment disorder, those two indicators. And now it's two totally different diagnoses. Because back when I was diagnosing it more, it was in that, the way it used to be.
Yeah.
But, I mean, she is a very clear, I mean, she has all that stuff of just not knowing how to have a parent and how to have a healthy attachment and how to have life skills and how to be regular.
And in this world that she's in and that the story is in, part of what helps with survival of mutants is blending in and people not knowing. And she, like Logan, has a way to hide, right?
Yeah.
What she has, because the blades go back into their body. That sounded really weird.
Their claws go back into their skin.
Yeah, that's way better. So being able to hide that, but then also not being able to be around other people, kind of blend in more, can really have a problem with her surviving.
She's hella aggressive. Like, she, when she's on that little pony, the mechanical pony, she's trying to rip the coin thing off. Then she goes into the store, she starts stealing stuff, doesn't really understand that she's stealing things.
And then
fucking kills the clerk.
Yeah.
Right. Like, she has no gauging. Like, like I said, like, she's either black or white, and either you're a threat and you're in my way and I'm going to plow through you, or you aren't in my way and so I can put up with you.
Right.
There's
right.
not really, like, an either or, which, of course, is you can't have, you're going to have conflict in life, and you need to have conflict without ripping someone's head off.
That is important to functioning in society.
Well, and I guess what I'd say, if I'm going to ground this in reality, how it more likely presents in children who are not experimentally created mutants in a future that is yet to come,
right?
Is starting fights all the time.
Yes.
Like getting in your face. I mean, getting really aggressive though. And like, I've had little kids throw things that they seem like they should not be able to physically throw at me, throw at their parents, like get really aggressive, bite me, kick me, you know, and all this stuff. I mean, I don't hold it against them. And a lot of what I do with parents is telling them not to treat it personal, because these kids are in survival mode. So they are in fight or flight all the time, fight, flight or freeze. And so they aren't coming after you because they want to ruin your day. They're coming after you physically because they either see you as a threat, they're trying to control the situation by being as aggressive as possible.
Right.
Or they're just having all these feelings they don't know how to manage because they're in a situation they just aren't used to. And so they react by throwing a tantrum. But unfortunately, they're not two anymore. And they can really do damage when they
throw a tantrum. And they're really trying to get their needs met. But yeah, they don't know any other way how to do it.
So or how to communicate it.
Or how to communicate what they need to their caregivers.
So in a more realistic case, you would, like in a kid that had this diagnosis, you would see more like throwing things, smashing things, like destruction of property is pretty common. Mm-hmm.
Very common.
And just like running off, you know, running away, eloping, locking themselves mm-hmm. in a room. You know, it's very like fight or flight mm-hmm. with these kind of kids. And so that's what it would more look like in a real life situation where they're not like, you know, full of knives.
Right.
Okay, so if we started to encounter these characters in reality, mm-hmm. what would we want to do as far as treatment for them?
So I thought about, so I spent most of the movie kind of putting them into this little like family and like how looking at the dynamics and how it's really changed and how there's so many different things happening. Really, I mean, which I think we talked about Logan the longest, so many different things happening with him. So it's, for me, it's kind of like we have this three generation family, right? Mm-hmm. So we have Charles, the dad, Logan, who's his son, and then Laura, who is Logan's daughter. And mm-hmm. so what I was thinking about is what if, which is, this is pretty hypothetical, it's kind
of
out there.
That's the point of this podcast, right, girl.
Okay, so what if Charles and Logan came in together?
Okay.
Which is pretty, in this situation, well, I guess, is pretty rare. But
why,
like,
would you think they would be coming in?
That's why I mean it's pretty out there, because it would, in most cases
you'd probably, I would, not to steal your spotlight, but you'd probably see Logan.
You'd probably would see Logan more often than not. You'd probably see him. They do have some things that they do with families, like in hospice, where they do some family therapy around the what's going on, and they talk about caregiver fatigue, and they usually have somebody who comes in and talks to the family before hospice comes in. I don't know if you guys know that, but that is something that happens. And so I guess I would, looking at it where maybe, so maybe a more realistic idea then is having Logan and Laura come in. Mm-hmm. And having them come in and kind of, because they didn't know that they were father and daughter, and having them come in together and kind of talking with them about how they can connect to each other and the struggles that they're going to have, because they're both so...
They're very similar, which probably
they're
would
very be. Similar.
That would probably cause as much strife as it would cause commiseration.
Well, I mean, they're literally clones, so
yeah. Well, and they're all, but they're also so busy being detached from everything and mm-hmm. trying,
they shut down
and
very
trying
similar
not
ways.
To be connected. Mm-hmm. And so, just kind of trying, as you know, as usual, which I usually talk about, is having them be able to talk to each other and having mm-hmm. kind of learning how to create a safe space.
I mean, they scream at each other in that movie, and they swear at each other
a lot,
a lot,
a lot. Uh-huh. So it'd be a lot of what can you do to take care of when you're feeling like this, and doing some psychoeducation about managing your own shit and being able mm-hmm. to come down so that you can have a conversation with this person who's now part of your family. And I feel like if I saw Logan by himself, if he came in, we would do a lot of talking about grief and talking about mm-hmm. his identity and how things have been different for him. So it was a little tricky because as a family therapist, it'd be a little tricky because I think that there's not a very good chance that you would see all of them at once. I think Logan and Laura maybe, and I think that they would come in mm-hmm. if we're looking at a situation that's more like a parent who has adopted a child mm-hmm. and the mm-hmm. struggles that can go along with that. So I feel like that might be a case where I would see both of them and just helping them mm-hmm. really have expectations that make sense, having realistic expectations, because sometimes that can be hard.
I mean, I'll straight up piggyback off of you. Because I've worked with a lot of kids who are adopted or fostered, and they have reactive attachment disorder. And the strife that it causes within the family is a chronic, almost like a, eating the whole family up from the inside out in terms of your ex, like you said, like the expectations you have for this child, really understanding what the child's capable of. And like, because I mean, if we're going to boil it down with like Laura, for example, she doesn't even know how to use utensils.
Yeah. No, she doesn't.
Like, she starts eating with her hands. I'm so, you know, and she doesn't know how to behave in the world with people. Like, she starts, like, when she's ripping off the coin thing with the ponies. Like,
yeah.
Like, she doesn't know how to be. And so, with the parent, you have to, like, do a lot of stripping away, especially because I think she's 11, right? It's, you have to be like, listen, you need to forget everything you know about what 11-year-olds are supposed to look like and act like and be like, or what you were like when you were 11. I get that a lot. Or what, like, their siblings were like when they were 11. Stop comparing it. This kid is an anomaly. Or the, just let this kid be this kid. And so kind of the meeting where they're at, which is, right, do we need to start with basic life skills?
Absolutely.
Like, because a lot of what I do...
ADLs.
A lot of what I would do with parents too is what we call mapping, which is where you assess how old a kid is on different levels. And by that I mean, let's say you have an 11-year-old girl, and physically she looks 11. Intellectually, let's say she's very smart. So let's say intellectually she's 15.
Right.
But socially she's 5. Because she can have a conversation, you know what I mean? She can sit politely if she's asked. But emotionally, she's 2.
Yeah.
Life skills-wise, she's 3. And so what you're doing when you map that out for a parent and those discrepancies between the ages is being like, okay, so just because she looks 11, can talk like she's 16, you know what I mean? Can hang in there like maybe an 8-year-old, so like socially or whatever. If she's emotionally 2 then or 3, then you have to treat her like a 2 or 3-year-old when she's dealing with her emotions. And if that is like she's throwing tantrums, what would you do with a toddler who's throwing tantrums? You would ignore them. And then when they have consequences, they'd be very concrete. Like, you need to go to your room, or we're going to sit in time out together. Maybe you have to sit in time out next to them. And you have to do a lot of direct modeling. And by that, I mean, like, literally doing in front of the kid what you expect the kid to do, which is sitting, maybe sitting yourself in time out next to them, or showing or sitting down next to them when they're eating and using a knife and a fork and a spoon. And, or, you know, if you want the kid to practice like deep breathing as a coping skill, you would sit in front of the kid and you'd start doing deep breathing regardless. Like, maybe the kid's wailing and the kid keeps wailing for the next hour. You keep doing deep breathing or another coping skill around them. And they'll, because what you're doing is, like, when you're working with little kids, is it's like when we talk about imprinting like a duck kind of thing, is like they're literally just looking around them and seeing how do other people behave, mm-hmm, and modeling that. And so,
sure,
by mapping like that with parents, it can give them more of a concrete idea of where the kid's coming from and what to expect. And it can be a very illuminating experience, especially with kids I've worked with who are all over the place in terms of their ages. Like, because I work with kids who look older than they actually are chronologically.
Yeah.
And they're very smart, but they are too emotionally. So why are we trying to have like an in-depth abstract conversation with them when they're throwing a tantrum?
Right. They can't handle, like, that. That's not appropriate.
Where is this coming from? Why are you behaving this way? Don't you understand the consequences of your actions? And I'm like, this kid isn't, like, maybe they can have this conversation later about something totally different.
Yeah.
But they, when they're in the moment, they are throwing a tantrum like a little kid. And would you talk to a 2-year-old this way? No. You'd ignore them if that was appropriate, or you'd comfort them if that was appropriate, or you'd model for them if that was appropriate. And yeah, so it'd be a lot of trying to educate Logan about where she's at. Or I guess if, let's say she got adopted in Canada, like Logan still dies and she gets adopted in Canada. So okay, it's like educating the
adopted. Spoiler alert.
Well, yeah, we already prefaced it. But like, but educating the parents of, like, this is what this kid needs. Can you hang and be this for this kid? And also a lot of times when I work with adoptive parents who've gotten a kid who has these issues, is the way it presents, like we've said, is these kids don't sometimes have a really hard trouble detaching because they don't trust adults to take care of them. They don't trust that what's the benefit of depending on someone else or giving someone else your heart.
Exactly.
You know, and being emotionally attached to them because either they were neglected or they were mistreated or, like, that person, like, only took care of them for 2 months and they were someone else who took care of them for a month and then da-da-da-da-da. So there's no positive.
They don't have any trust that...
Yeah. Well, there
that
was no reward.
That an adult, exactly. They don't have any trust that an adult would stick around and really take care of them and give them what they needed.
So a lot of what I've had to do with parents of kids with reactive attachment is be like, hey, are you having... Do we need to grieve the idea of the child that you thought you were going to have?
Which is important step of it.
Can you let go of having a child that will ever say I love you or will want to hug you? Because some of these kids, like, they don't like being hugged or being touched, and they will, like, the idea of saying I love you is a horrifying, terrifying thing. And so a lot of parents, understandably, will get very distraught and frustrated because they're with this kid who seems to not love them and not care about any of the things they're doing for them. And then on top of that, this kid is, like, freaking out of them all the time and hurting them and running away and just not being maybe the kid that they dreamt about when they were going through the adoptive process, and possibly in some cases infertility and IVF and all this loss of, because a lot of times by the time people get to adoption, they've already
exhausted other
avenues. And there's so much energy behind, I'm going to have this kid. And once they've thought about this kid so much and this child that'll finally make them feel better, and this nightmare will be over with, and I'll finally have this child. And then they get this adopted child, and this child is nothing like they imagined. And that's not the parent's fault. But it's a lot of it is, do we need to grieve the child that you thought you were going to have? And can you let go of that? Because a lot of times when I work with, and I work with very extreme cases, so I want to preface it with that, like, not all kids with reactive attachment, like, go to these extremes or have this poor of a prognosis, because they can get better. But the most success I've ever had with kids with reactive attachment is when their parents can come to some sort of sense of peace about what their kid's capable of, what they may get or not ever get from this child in front of them, like, kind of letting go of what they wanted from this relationship and instead kind of letting the kid be whatever the kid needs to be. And a lot of times when I've had situations like that and the parent kind of finally relaxes into it, then, funny enough, the kid will sometimes start to grow towards the parent, because there's not this energy on this kid of, like, why don't you love me? Like,
what's,
well,
all these
give me
expectations
and
put on their little shoulders?
Right, yeah. And we watch out for the caregiver fatigue developing resentment.
Sure. And a lot of times
resentment is one of the most dangerous. When you're talking about, like, couples work, resentment is one of the Gottman's four horsemen. And when you're talking about, like, caregivers with parents, like, the caregiver fatigue can develop this resentment in a relationship. And even these kids that have low social intelligence are going to be able to detect when someone is frustrated and angry with them.
And then it fits into their narrative of, correct, I'm unlovable. All my caregivers don't
Nobody
love
can
me.
Handle
like,
me.
No one can handle me. I'm going to ruin this relationship before it can get ruined for me. And this narrative continues. And so, I mean, and a lot of times what I suggest to parents is, well, one, get your own therapist. And two, if you can find a support group, which is the great thing about online communities now, as I'm sure there's online communities for parents of reactive attached, like RAD kids, is find a support group, because a lot of parents I've worked with feel like they're the only ones. And so once they get sort of more educated and read some books about it and get connected with other parents, there is this sense of relief that comes from a community and from understanding that you're not the problem. Because a lot of times the kid would be acting this way regardless of who the caregiver was. Like, they are just seeing you as this caregiver figure that's, then they're just reaming against it. And it doesn't matter who it is. And so kind of helping them feel like it's not necessary. I mean, it's personal, but it's not personal in the same way. It's hard to describe it like that. But it's like this kid's just acting out. And it's not because they acting out personally towards you. It's because you're the caregiver in their life.
Yeah.
Because I've had kids that, like, I used to see a lot for intensive therapy. And by the time I was seeing them for a few weeks, I started becoming one of those caregivers. And they would start coming after me in a very similar fashion because I became a caregiver in their life that they saw as a possible threat.
Yeah. I had a similar experience. I didn't have reactive attachment, but I did have kids that had what we call severe emotional disturbance when I worked at University of Chicago. And there was there were many kids who we encountered the same issues where you could see the staff starting to get burned out and getting caregiver fatigue. They are hard kids, and sometimes they do reach the point where they are having a crisis and they've maxed out on their ability to cope, and their only option that they see is to react physically. And sometimes it reaches the point where the only thing you can do is to either physically restrain them or to keep them safe. Mm-hmm. And then I think this is an important thing you have to teach parents, is sometimes it reaches that point where you might have to intervene, but you can't be violent. Like, you can't be violent. Even if you have to physically restrain somebody, you must not do it violently.
Or, like, get some training about how to do it safely.
Right, which there are lots of ways. We were trained in therapeutic crisis intervention, TCI, and that was very helpful. And one of the things that I think is the most key component of that is that you do something called a life space interview afterwards, mm-hmm. which I think parents of difficult children need to realize that has to be done, is you can't have that conversation in the moment when someone's activated. You're not talking to a rational human being at that point in time. You can't expect to have why can't you just calm down? Like, it's not at that point, but they're calm, you can go back later and go, okay, let's talk about what happened. Where did this reach the point where it got out of control? Where did the teapot boil over?
What's a debriefing, basically?
It is, right. It is a debriefing.
And I think what you bring up as important is that, and for our parents to understand, is it's, people, even us professionals, get burnout. Like, when I work with kids like that, because I worked at a partial hospital, so they were there six hours a day, 5 days a week. It was like school hours. And even us on staff, we would have to take turns. Like, we had to be very mindful of, I've spent a lot of time with this kid this week while he's been, you know, in the hallway screaming. So we're going to need to plank a plan where we trade out with other staff so that we don't get burnt out. And, you know, so that we don't take the easy way out with the kid. And if that means, like, tuning out or, you know, whatever, so that we're being what the kid needs all the time. And we're also taking care of ourselves. And a lot of times when I would talk to parents, like, if you have supports, like if they're a married couple or if they have family that's around and able to help, like, make sure that you're trading out. Make sure that you're taking shifts, that you're not always the one handling it.
I think that's what's part of the caregiver fatigue in the story in the movie, is mm-hmm. that it's only Logan and Caliban, and they don't have, and they're so isolated and don't have the resources that they need, which may not be the same for someone else, for other people, mm-hmm. but they only have each other, and they're not able to trade off.
Right.
Because Logan has to go out and make money and get the medication, and Caliban can't go outside. So it's like being really, they're just so stuck, and it would be so hard for them not to have caregiver fatigue.
Right. So then if we were to talk about Logan, I feel like you'd have to almost conceptualize Logan like a veteran.
Like that chronic level of trauma.
The chronic level of trauma, but also the mindset he's going to come from.
Survival mode.
Was he survival mode, and also like the masculinity, the not seeking help? I felt there was one like where like it can be looked down on to seek help. Like Logan is, for sure, like old school man gender mentality.
Roles. Yeah,
all old school.
Even the way he treats Caliban like a nagging wife. There's a very clear sense of like their gender roles.
Right.
When they're interacting.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and he. With Logan, you'd want to be sure that you're getting past that. I thought it was really interesting that the only other, like, classic man's man, the father from the farm, had a conversation with Logan about it. And they were talking about, I thought it was interesting that he started, like, talking about the escapism, going, like, you know, like, there's always, like, a pill or an app or something you use to distract yourself from this or that. Like, I remember when a bad day was just a bad day.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was an interesting thing to talk with Logan about, because Logan is always seeking that escape. But he's not going to do it in a way where he's seeking a pill or an app. He's going to go for booze.
Well, he also definitely falls into like machismo behaviors that are lauded, like mm-hmm. having sex with hot ladies and smoking cigars and getting in cage fights. And like, I mean, how many men probably look at him like a badass and don't think about all the things going underneath it and how maladaptive those behaviors are, because it looks cool.
Right. And he's empty and he's broken and he's afraid, but he doesn't want to show that because that's not being safe, so that he reacts and pushes away. But I think with Logan, it would be he'd be the most difficult client. You'd have to work with him. You'd have to work through a lot of resistance.
Yeah, buy-in for sure.
God, how?
Yeah.
What are the chances he even comes in?
Zero. Almost zero.
Also, he'd be that client that sits on the couch and glares at you and is like, "You gonna tell me something, Doc?" I'd probably call you Shrink or something.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. you see it even with the professor in Jean Grey. I think it's in the first X-Men, if not the second.
Wheels. He does the nicknaming stuff, like off-putting, like cock of the walk kind of shit.
Right.
To make you defensive and to make you act out, and then he can be like, see?
Right. See?
Like, and you're a asshole too.
But I think he'd have to be forced to do it.
I was gonna say, he'd probably be court
mandated. Well, here's the thing. He would probably go in for Laura. I think. Like, if she really needed it, like, let's really draw a cute little picture. And let's say he lives, they get a little house, like, cabin style, like Wolverine, when he had that wife, and they put her in school, and she definitely would fall apart, and probably do something crazy, like chop a desk in half, I don't know. And they'd be like, you have to go to therapy for her to stay in school, which is a lot of times why people would come to my therapist office when I worked at the PHP, is the school was like, either you're going to get expelled or you're going to go to this program for a little while.
Yeah.
And so I had a lot of parents who definitely probably wouldn't have gone to therapy if they weren't feeling coerced.
Yeah.
And so I definitely think in that situation, I think he'd go for her.
Yeah.
And then that would be the doorway in, because with a kid like her, you'd have to work a lot with the parent. Yeah. And then you'd probably end up being like, hey, buddy, what's going on here? Why can't, like, in order for him to be a stable model for her.
Right. For him, I think, honestly, the point with him, you'd have to get to, you'd want to be exploring a safety plan, which I don't think he'd go for, number one, but...
He'd be like, safety plans are for bitches.
Something similar.
he'd pull out the bullets, I have a safety plan.
This is
plan.
My safety, oh my god, he would.
He would!
Yeah, I think so. assuming you could get buy-in from him, it would be difficult, I'm an EMDR practitioner, and so I want to think EMDR, but I don't think he'd be an appropriate case
for
that.
Can you do EMDR with someone who has had amnesia? Because he's had amnesia.
I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I suspect you can, but you'd want to be consulting with their other medical providers, particularly their doctor and a neurologist. Yeah, I think you can.
Well, and also, I guess you'd probably have to be weary of what you might unearth, because... And he gets amnesia because he gets shot in the head, right?
I don't remember the story.
We don't have to get into it.
Yeah.
But a lot of people have blocked memories because it's really traumatic. And so you have to be very, careful of what you might unearth.
You have to be absolutely careful. But why I would choose not to do it with him is that I don't think he has the coping skills for it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
100% correct.
He's not ready.
Go out and he'd go on a bender. He'd go out and he'd get shit-faced for 3 days. After something hard came up.
Likely. I just don't think he'd be able to. He'd leave. I think he'd get up when it got hard.
I was going to say, I think he'd leave. I think that
he'd probably slam you against a wall by the collar.
I don't think he'd go that far, but
I think he'd physically.
But EMDR gets...
He likes to grab a bitch by the collar.
He does.
Well, I don't think of myself as a bitch, so...
He would, though.
He would.
He might. Like,
yeah.
Your fancy degrees, college boy.
Right.
What my mind is about.
But I think we'd want to work on that depression with him. I think we want to work on his sense of identity because he's lost so much.
I mean, he doesn't even have his look in this movie.
No.
The kids give him his look at the end with the beard.
It's one of my favorite.
But I mean, this is the only movie where he doesn't have the crazy ass hair and the facial hair thing.
Right. So with Logan, you'd want to work on coping skills with him and an ability to almost go existential with him and figure out who are you, who do you want to be, what will give your life meaning, almost adopting a logo therapy kind of stance with him.
What do you mean logo?
Yeah.
So when I say logo therapy was a therapy developed by a Viennese psychiatrist named Viktor Frankl. He wrote an extremely popular and helpful book called Man's Search for Meaning, which was written when he was in a concentration camp in World War II, where he noticed that the people that survived were the people that took on roles They brought some sort of meaning or purpose to the place. So the people in the nursing, or people in the camp that, okay, I was the doctor before, so I'm going to be the doctor now, or I'm going to be the healer, I'm going to be a cook. Like, the people that had some purpose were the ones that were able to get through the process. So I think like adopting that philosophy with Logan and learning how, okay, how do you make meaning even out of suffering? What is your life brought to the world? What makes you feel like you have purpose now? What kinds of things make you feel like you mean something to the world and to those around you?
And I feel like you'd be able to get buy-in from him by him saying, wanting to be a father for Laura and wanting to be a caregiver for her. I feel like that would be a way to get around some of his resistance and to get some buy-in from him as a client and as somebody who is active in therapy.
Because as we've seen with like Rogue, like he is able to be invested in that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
Or Jean, when Cyclops was out of the picture, like you could see him wanting to do that.
He is kind of like, he would never admit to it, but he is kind of a natural caregiver. And if you said that to him, he'd be very
Then he might collar grab you.
Yeah.
I'll say it again. And I'd be like, you are.
Then you get called bub. That's what's going
to
happen.
Yeah. But I mean, I think definitely, yeah, the bind would probably have to be the relationship with Laura. Because he has no self-worth, so why would he work on himself if he thinks that he is worthless?
Right. And I think that creating that sense of self-worth would be the direction I would take with him. It wouldn't be looking for a fancy treatment. It wouldn't be following necessarily a scripted protocol. There are absolutely like protocols you do with it, but it's a far more philosophical thing of existential approaches in general, more about finding meaning, purpose, fit in life. And I think for him, where he's at now, that would be the only way I could see him getting buy-in, because I could see him like, okay, what are your coping skills? What can you do? Like, can we find things to do? Other people you can talk to, but fuck you, bub.
Yeah.
That's what would happen.
Man.
And I think could be a really good conversation with him is because of his lifespan, he's had to be constantly changing who he is to, like, live that long. Like, you can't be the same person in the world and you've lived 300 years.
Well, you're so busy hiding and changing.
Yeah. He hasn't had an identity because he couldn't maintain one and not be cut up like an experiment.
Yeah.
Like, you can't be the same person for 200 years when you're not aging. So he probably hasn't had a sense of self for as long as he has been cognizant of living immortally.
Right. He must be near like 400 by this movie.
Well, I mean, 17-something
when
he was a kid. It's 2049. So he's probably 300-something.
And he's fought through
all the wars. Which is something definitely, that would be something to talk about in therapy. Like, hey, why are you insisting upon being in every single war that mankind has ever fought in over the whole of your life? That's a coping skill.
Yeah, it is. All right, so final thoughts on Logan.
Very good movie. Very thoughtful movie. Presented a lot of topics that you wouldn't see in a superhero movie for sure, and proposed them very successfully and thoughtfully. And I really liked that it wasn't trying to be a glossy shoot 'em up either.
Yeah, it's
dark as fuck.
It is. I mean, this was the second R-rated superhero movie, and I think it needed to be to communicate what it needed to do on, like, the visceral human level and tell the story of Old Man Logan, which is what this is based on. But to show that story accurately and to depict who Wolverine is, I mean, I loved it. I thought this movie was fantastic. It has something like a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes.
It got nominated for an Oscar, I think.
It deserved it.
Yeah, it got nominated for, like, Best Original Screenplay or Best Adapted Screenplay.
It must be adapted.
Probably.
And I think something else, too. But, and it is like, if you took the mutant part of it out, like, it is like a drama.
It is. It's a great human story. It's a great farewell to Wolverine for Hugh Jackman. His performance, I mean, as always, was excellent. But I absolutely loved this movie. It's a tough watch. It's not one I'll probably watch over and over, but it's a great film, and it was very well done, and it displayed great understanding of the human condition and where in life these people might be who've gone through these really, really hard struggles.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I agree with both of you. I really love this movie, and I think that they did a really good job of bringing it to an end for both of them and really showing you what the relationship ended up being, and just a really interesting way to do that with adding this extra component of Laura into the story. And I just think I really love this movie, and I have a lot of favorite parts. I was like, oh, I'll say like what my favorite part is at the end. No, I have like 10 favorite parts, so it'll take too long. But
the part when her bat claw comes out for the first time.
It was awesome. Pretty cool. One of my favorite parts, though, really is when the kids cut his facial hair and they're just like giggling, and they cut his facial hair into like the Wolverine facial hair. That's really one of my favorite parts of the movie. It's very cute and also very sweet, and also very just like for like myself to see him, like to see him like that again before we don't see him anymore. So I just love this movie, and I watch it way too much.
I think my favorite part was when Laura comes back and just, like, throws the guy's head on the ground.
It's pretty fucking awesome.
I mean, she was, like, such a badass. But then also, like, when Wolverine's dying and you see the kid with, like, the old school 90s yellow and blue Wolverine toy. Oh,
yeah. I didn't notice.
That little kid.
Brittany told me. I didn't notice adorable. That happened.
He might be one of my favorite parts of that movie.
Oh, and also when they kill the bad guy. When all the kids gang up and kill the one really nasty guy.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
His name I can't remember. That part is fucking awesome.
That was awesome.
They all just attack him and like use all of their powers together to kill him.
Oh, and I think it was just a really cool that in this time when like the superhero movies keep getting bigger and bigger with more and more characters, that they made the...
Yes.
Decision, which I guess was kind of daring, to boil down the story to like three characters.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
make it a very humanistic story and not dependent on like glitz and glamour and like 800 characters.
And tons of CGI. And
yeah. The only really neat effects is because they have two Logans happening at once and they have to like superimpose his face.
When his claws coming through people's heads.
Yeah. I mean, like that stuff. But like, other than that, like, there isn't a lot of like.
Yeah.
Like, shoot them up, bang them up, big, huge things. It's very grounded in reality, as much as it can be.
Right.
It was. So we all clearly loved Logan. we'd love to hear your thoughts on it. You can follow us on Instagram, on Facebook, and Twitter, all at Popcorn Psychology. We look forward to hearing from you. We have a fan group on our Facebook where you can provide suggestions of movies you want to hear us cover. This was one that we got a while ago, so it was one of the first ones we got. Thank you, Liam. This is just a great movie, and I'm really happy we did it. And going forward, if you guys have suggestions for us, we'd love to hear them. Love you to connect with us. But beyond that, we look forward to seeing you on our next episode.